This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 3 years after the sex abuse and cover-up scandal erupted in Boston, Catholic archdioceses around the country continue to deal with the financial impact of lawsuits filed by victims. Like many defendants who face substantial claims, the church, or its component parts, use the protection of the law. Some archdioceses, including Spokane, Washington, and Portland, Oregon, filed for bankruptcy. In both of those cases, the church tried to reduce its financial exposure by claiming that land and buildings that might be sold off to settle lawsuits belonged not to the archdiocese, but to local parishes. On the other side of the country, the church is lobbying against a proposal to lift the statute of limitations in Pennsylvania to allow alleged victims to file claims of abuse from decades ago. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia and others around the state argue that additional claims would leave them bankrupt. Broadly, the church and its supporters say that the sex abuse lawsuits threaten to devastate the mission of the church. Victims and their supporters say the church is using legal technicalities to avoid its moral and financial obligations. If you have questions about the legal arguments, give us a call. Or if your archdiocese is facing financial difficulty because of lawsuits, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. Later in the program, your calls about the life and influence of Richard Pryor, who died over the weekend. But first, bankruptcy in the Catholic Church. David O'Reilly covers religion for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He joins us now from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil.
As I understand it, the majority of people wishing to bring claims against the Catholic Church in the state of Pennsylvania have not been able to because of the state's the statute of limitations.
Absolutely. The statute of limitation enjoys a rather privileged status in Pennsylvania law, and courts have been loath to change it, and we don't know whether the legislature will change it. But there is a move underfoot being urged by the Philadelphia District Attorney to create a one-year window that would allow victims to file retroactively civil cases.
Mm-hmm.
And needless to say, the Archdiocese of Philadelphia and the other Catholic dioceses don't like this at all.
And that has been done, as I understand it, in some other states where the same kind of issue has come up.
Famously in California, they did a one-year window in 2003. And if that didn't scare the red cap off of Cardinal Regali here in Pennsylvania, I don't know what would. 800 victims came forward in 1 year in California. It's a very scary prospect for any diocese. And some of the settlements there are running about $1 million per victim. Mm-hmm. in California.
And this, as you're mentioning, this is particularly a concern for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia.
Well, Philadelphia is, of course, the largest jurisdiction in the state of Pennsylvania, so they would be impacted more than any other. We don't know how many victims there are yet, but there was a long grand jury investigation in Philadelphia. It lasted 40 months. And came out only in September. And that identified, they simply said hundreds of victims. They mm-hmm. couldn't even tell for sure. So we don't know how many, but it would be enormous.
Now, there is a proposed alternative to just, shutting these people out and not giving them an opportunity to file, a victim's fund.
Yes. Yes. The argument for that would be that it would spare the diocese, excruciating the embarrassing revelations about how they handle sex abuse cases, and would move more expeditiously than individual trials might. It still could be very expensive. Some dioceses have done settlements of that nature, but they have not been cheap. I think that they would love if they could duck any sort of payments, but they may not be able to.
You say excruciating revelations. In other words, unlike in Massachusetts, for example, we don't yet know what happened in terms of the of sex abuse by individual priests and then their apparent protection by the hierarchy.
Well, I don't know about Boston. There was really plenty of revelations, but the grand jury here in Philadelphia was able to get all sorts of private files and things like personnel files from the archdiocese, and that revealed a pattern of concealment. And when the grand jury wrote its report with the assistance of the district attorney, it was absolutely devastating, absolutely scathing, very, very forceful and very embarrassing. And some of the former archbishops here will really go down in history with, I'm afraid, wearing two black eyes.
As we're talking about the financial impact of civil lawsuits against the church, is there any contemplation at this point of criminal charges?
The courts tend not to like a retroactive lifting of statute in criminal cases. It's a form. Well, anyway, it's not popular in law. So the only real remedy, if you can call it a remedy, would be financial. Not that they can clap guys behind bars if the statute of limitations has expired. It would be civil.
How and when is this issue likely to be resolved?
Well, there are murmurings and burblings coming out of the state legislature where certain lawmakers do express all sorts of sympathy. But to date, no one in the Pennsylvania legislature has actually submitted proposed legislation. So it looks as if the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference, as it's called, is working vigorously behind the scenes, admonishing lawmakers that it would have a devastating impact on the schools and the social services that they do, that they provide. And I think the lawmakers are paying attention. Same thing happened in Ohio, incidentally. The Ohio Catholic Conference was able to thwart such a move. And I suspect that the Pennsylvania Catholic Conference has learned a few lessons from that bit of lobbying.
David O'Reilly, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David O'Reilly is religion reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and he joined us from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. Well, temporarily waiving the statute of limitations in Pennsylvania could herald, as we mentioned, a dramatic increase in the number of sex abuse claims filed against the Catholic Church in that state. Critics of the proposed change say these claims could have less integrity than those filed for more recent incidents. Mark Sargent is dean and professor of law at Villanova's University School of Law, and he joins us now from the studios, also at Audio Post in Philadelphia. And Dean Sargent, nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Why, again, we know that Pennsylvania has an exceptionally tight statute of limitations, but why not lift it 1 year exemption to provide the victims of sex abuse to file lawsuits?
Well, I guess, first of all, I don't know that Pennsylvania has an exceptionally tight statute of limitations. It's typical of what you see around the country with respect to sexual abuse and similar kinds of offense. The Pennsylvania courts have been somewhat reluctant to toll the statute of limitations or suspend it in individual cases mm-hmm. on a theory of fraudulent concealment, finding that plaintiffs who've attempted to use that argument haven't been able to prove it. But our law is typical of that of many other jurisdictions. The larger question, I think, is whether it's a good idea to suspend the statute of limitations as was done in California and as has been proposed in other jurisdictions, but to my knowledge has not been done in other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. The first question is this, or the first problem is this. Statutes of limitation are there for a purpose. These are not technicalities or legal loopholes. They recognize that parties who've been injured need to bring their causes of action within a timely fashion, not so much to protect defendants, but because the ability to get at the truth of a matter, what actually happened, how bad it was, how serious it was, how prolonged it was, what the nature of the damage was, the ability of plaintiffs to establish all that diminishes over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't that for a jury to decide?
Well, I guess it is ultimately, but the law has always taken the position that we're not going to put everything in the hands of the jury, that it makes sense to limit what a jury can see. In Pennsylvania, you're talking about offenses as found by the Philadelphia grand jury back to 1967. So the ability to actually come up with a case that's strong and probative is at least in question. But that's not the most important issue, though I believe it is an important issue and shouldn't be dismissed out of hand as if statutes of limitation were just some sort of silly obstacle and we mm-hmm. should let juries do what they want. The biggest problem is the scope of potential damages. I don't think anyone, and including me, who does not represent the Archdiocese or anybody else in these kinds of litigation, is concerned about the proportionality of the damages. I don't think we can dispute that the victims of sexual abuse, of which there have been many, are entitled to some kind of compensation. But we're talking about the potential liabilities such as have arisen in California. We're talking about who else is going to be injured, including the beneficiaries of the educational programs, the social service programs, and the pastoral programs of the various archdioceses. In California, you had about 800 lawsuits. The projected settlements are $1.5 billion, which is a significant amount of money. And plaintiffs' lawyers say, well, this is all going to be handled by insurance and by selling the real estate that isn't used for the for mission purposes, selling the Cardinals estate in Boston, for example, which I think everyone would agree no one really needed. But I think a much fairer estimation is that it's going to cause bleeding. It's going to cause significant cutbacks in the services that the diocese provide. So we're not punishing the bishops or the chancery officials who did the things that injured these survivors so grievously. We're going to be injuring people who had absolutely no idea of what was going on and who are truly innocent. So we see that kind of proportionality problem, and it would surely be a serious problem here in
Philadelphia. Just a moment. You're choosing to say that the individuals, the bishops before, were responsible, and of course the priests themselves. Isn't the institution responsible to some degree?
No, the institution is responsible to some degree. But the institution isn't like a corporation where you have shareholders who assume the risk of managerial wrongdoing and choose to put their money into a company where the whole investment may go down the tubes because the managers engage in fraud or some other kind of wrongdoing. So it's easy to talk about the institution, but it's very difficult to talk about it apart from those people who benefit from the positive things that the institution does.
We're talking about Catholic Archdiocese and the financial fallout of sexual abuse lawsuits coming up. After the break, we'll be joined by a professor on bankruptcy law and a representative for sexual abuse advisors. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Cunningham. We'll be back after the break. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing bankruptcy in the Catholic Church in the wake of sexual abuse and cover-up lawsuits. Still with us is Mark Sargent, Dean and Professor of Law at Villanova University in Villanova, Pennsylvania. And, of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. And let's begin with Tawny. Tawny's calling us from Lodi, California.
Yes. I couldn't agree more with your previous speaker that by financially punishing the church, treating it like a corporation, it really punishes the Catholic people who are attending Mass and receiving services that Catholic charities and the likes provide. I went to parochial school. My son is currently a sophomore at parochial school. I really think that they need to look more at holding these bishops and cardinals. Bishop Mahoney was the bishop here when I was in high school, and now he's a cardinal in L.A., I would prefer that they sought justice in holding these men accountable opposed to seeking justice through fiscal means.
And doesn't the church, Tawny, owe something to those parishioners who were abused by the church's representatives, the priests?
Well, I have to say that I feel, you know, of course, just speculating, but I feel like if this had happened to my son, there isn't enough money in the world that could unring that bell. But I'd want to know that they were doing everything they could to make sure that all of those men who either participated in the act or in the act of covering it up were going to be behind bars and disrobed, and I could know that the church is moving on in truth opposed to a financial payoff. The money wouldn't mean anything to me.
Mm-hmm. And Dean Sargent, thank you very much for the call, Tawny,
by
the way.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dean Sargent, one of the ways that lawyers say civil lawsuits do to correct the institution, the behavior of institutions, is by imposing a punitive penalty, saying, now you won't do it again.
Well, obviously, there was missing throughout this whole sad story any significant disincentive for handling these cases the way they were. Mm-hmm. And I certainly present no apology for the way that these were handled in Philadelphia or elsewhere. And the interim effect of substantial liabilities obviously can have an encouraging effect in the future. However, I come back to the question of proportionality. I'm certainly not opposed to the concept of some financial remuneration for the victims. I don't oppose the notion of a fund that was worked out with the victims to provide for some form of compensation that drew on the diocese insurance and drew upon real estate holdings that are not related to the mission. I frankly don't oppose that, and I think it could have a clarifying effect for the future.
Mm-hmm. Who gets to decide what's what? The court?
Well, under these circumstances, we'd be talking about the kind of negotiated settlement that you see in a class action suit against a corporation, for example. But it's hard to see how that would happen unless plaintiffs do have an ability to bring a suit, which under the current law in Pennsylvania and many other jurisdictions, they're barred from doing by the statute of limitations.
Let's get another caller on.
It would have to be voluntary by the diocese.
I understand. Barbara joins us now from Sacramento.
Hi. Thanks for letting me talk on your show. I enjoy your show every day as well.
Thank you. I
wanted to comment that in Sacramento, we've had a lot of sexual abuse cases, and I really believe somewhat what your guest just said, that the church, I think, will respond if there's a financial penalty for overlooking what their priests and bishops or whoever was involved was doing with the kids. And I also agree with the caller who just called and said there's no amount of money that can help them. And especially in our news local paper, a couple of injured parties talked about their lives and how they've never been able to get them right. They,
mm-hmm.
they haven't been able to get the jobs they want or whatever because their lives are so devastated. But I also think it's odd that in Sacramento we spent $34 million renovating a cathedral in downtown Sacramento. And I just think if we have that kind of money for a church, then we have money to pay for helping out the people that were injured. And I also think that the church should go a lot farther in, I don't know if you want to punish the people who were responsible, but at least not kick them out of the church. I mean, at a minimum, they should be kicked out of the church. So, thanks.
Thanks very much, Barbara.
You're welcome.
And Mark Sargent, obviously that one case in Sacramento, but people do look at sometimes lavish church buildings and say, boy, there's plenty of money there.
Well, they do. Here they point to the St. Charles Borromeo Seminary, which is a large campus in Philadelphia, which some have valued at $68 million, and the argument is, well, they're not using that seminary for very much. Why don't they just sell that and give all the money to the survivors? I guess one would have to assume that they're not putting it to a positive use there, and you know, that's certainly debatable. But again, it comes down to the question of scale. To be sure, if you go around the diocese around the country, you will find uses which in the Catholic tradition have amounted to the creating of great edifices, whether they're churches or other types of institutions. You know, I think we need to be careful in saying that, well, that's a waste and that should all go to another purpose. The fact remains, however, that most of the resources of most dioceses go into service, into pastoral service, social service, and educational service. And while there may be some fat that can be carved off that some might describe as being superfluous to the mission of the church, there's an awful lot of bone and muscle, the excision of which would produce a lot of harm. One thing I should add, that there are a lot of ways to compensate victims. One thing that's remarkable about survivors, and I don't know if I would have this greatness of heart and magnanimity, many have been satisfied by the one thing they haven't got, which is acknowledgement and apology. Deeply felt, heartfelt apologies from the diocese, from the bishops. We've seen some of that in the Diocese of Camden across the river here in New Jersey, which has had a remarkable effect. I don't think most survivors are just greedy and out to get everything they can get. And I think it's incumbent upon not just the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, but dioceses around the country before they start screaming about the damages, which the damage which a suspension of limitations could do. But they need to think of other ways of putting their house in order. And that includes also dealing with the priests who are still in some form of ministry. Another way to look at that is that canon law, the internal law of the church, if it had been followed in most dioceses, if it had been followed in the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, and there had been a canonical investigation of what is a canonical crime, that is, the sexual abuse of minors, if that had been followed, the Philadelphia grand jury report would be 2 pages long rather than 600 pages long, and the report would have been, the church had a mechanism for doing this, they used it, they investigated these crimes, and they dismissed these priests from ministry.
That did not happen. Mark Sargent, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Mark Sargent, Dean and Professor of Law at Villanova University in Villanova, Pennsylvania. And he joined us from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. And also there at that studio is David Skeel, a professor of bankruptcy and corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of Debt's Dominion, A History of Bankruptcy Law in America. And some archdioceses have gone into bankruptcy as a way to deal with the lawsuits filed by sex abuse victims. And let's talk about some of those cases. David Skeel, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
And in Portland, Oregon, the Catholic Church is arguing that, of course, lawsuits have been filed against the archdiocese, and it's arguing that, well, it doesn't own the properties. The properties are, in fact, belong to the parishes.
That's exactly right. This is perhaps the biggest issue in the three bankruptcy, or in the two of the three bankruptcy cases that we have.
That's Portland and Spokane, right?
Portland and Spokane. The argument that the Archdiocese of Portland is making is that although they legally seem to own the property, although their name is in the title of the property, really the property is owned by the parishes, and therefore this property is not available for compensating victims in the bankruptcy case.
Now, courts in Spokane argued that the parish property did indeed belong to the Archdiocese.
That is correct. What was argued by the victims in Spokane and what the court agreed with was that the legal title ought to control. If the property says it belongs to the Archdiocese, we ought to presume that it is in fact the Archdiocese's property. I won't try to say that again.
Okay.
And the argument is the legal owner ought to be treated as the actual owner presumptively, and that means all that property should be available to compensate victims potentially, and that means things like the churches and the schools in the archdiocese.
And there's also an element of separation of church and state here. Religion, canonical law, the church argues, says the archbishop of the archdiocese, his oath requires him not to disperse parish property because under church law, that belongs to the parish.
That is the position that the Portland and Spokane diocese have taken. That position was rejected by the court in Spokane, and that issue is now being decided in Portland.
And where does that case stand at the moment?
The case has been argued, and at this point, we're waiting for a decision.
And we should point out there was another archdiocese, that in Tucson, Arizona, that also declared bankruptcy. They handled it quite differently.
That's exactly right. The diocese in Tucson came into the case with a proposed plan, a proposed plan of payment for the victims. The case was resolved relatively quickly, and there was an agreement to pay a total of $22.2 million to the victim. And by the standards of these cases, it was resolved in a fairly friendly fashion, and that case is now out of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. Now, if the courts in Oregon do rule that the parish property does not belong to the archdiocese, what implications would that have?
Well, it really affects the amount of money that's available to victims. What the Archdiocese in Portland has said is available is $10 million if it doesn't own all that property. If it does own the property, it will be tens of millions of dollars more. So it really affects the bargaining between the two parties. If the court says the Archdiocese doesn't own the property, the church can take a pretty tough position about what it's going to pay. If the church loses, it will be put in a position where it's going to have to offer a lot more.
And is that the case in what's happening in Spokane now?
That's my sense, although there's so much animosity in both of these cases that it's hard to say that there's really a moving forward on the negotiations at all. Mm-hmm. But that there is a sense that the leverage in the case has shifted and the church in Spokane will have to be more generous about what it ends up offering.
David Skeel, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
David Skeel, professor of bankruptcy and corporate law at the University of Pennsylvania, also the author of Debt's Dominion, A History of Bankruptcy Law in America, and he was with us from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia. We're talking about the fallout from the sex abuse and cover-up crisis in the Catholic Church, the financial and legal fallout. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. After the break, we're also going to be talking about the life and the contributions of comedian Richard Pryor, so stay tuned for that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For the victims of sex abuse by Catholic clergymen, legal technicalities are less important than the opportunity to bring their cases forward. David Clossy is National Director of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, or SNAP, and he joins us now from Clayton Studios in St. Louis, Missouri, and it's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. My pleasure.
Critics of lifting the statute of limitations in Pennsylvania warn about the possibility of false claims or claims that are just going to be impossible to prove that go back so far.
Well, two things. First of all, the church's own leading legal defense lawyer, a man who's represented more than 500 accused priests, has told the New York Times that less than 10 of those more than 500 accused priests were innocent. Secondly, we believe that fundamentally juries should be able to determine the truth or falsity. And third, we think that these are crimes that are heinous and that are likely to be repeated. So if there has to be some flexibility in the law about allowing victims of certain crimes their day in court, that flexibility should be extended to people who are raped and sodomized as children by the most powerful people we can imagine. They're clergymen.
Mm-hmm. And people they trusted, and of course people who were representatives of an institution in which they invested, they and their families, a great deal of trust.
Absolutely, and an institution that's able to use guilt and shame and years of religious instruction to intimidate their families into staying silent.
There is also, I've heard this argument from some victims to say that in the bankruptcy cases in particular, that they are in a sense being victimized again, being cast by the church or by its legal representatives as saying they are the ones who are trying to seize church property.
That's exactly right, Neil. What's happened, the common denominator in each of these three bankruptcy cases, and by the way, again, churches have chosen to seek bankruptcy protection. They haven't been forced into it. They chose this route. The common denominator here is in each case, it happened on the eve of a civil trial in which horrific secrets, as David O'Reilly pointed out, mm-hmm. horrific secrets about bishops' cover-ups were about to become public knowledge through trial proceedings. That's what church leaders fear the most. This argument that somehow they're worried about their assets, we fundamentally believe, is pure baloney. Remember, this is a monarchy. And it's a very secretive monarchy. And before a bishop even begins to claim, I just can't do right by these victims, we in SNAP feel that he owes it to Catholics to come clean with the diocese assets and their property and their insurance. And unless and until a bishop does this, unless a bishop says, here are my books, let a third party look at these, as long as bishops are secretive about their money, they don't have any business trying to intimidate victims from coming forward and beating down victims in the legal process and saying, gee, we just don't have the assets to do right by these victims.
Let's get a caller in before we have to go to the break. Tim. Tim's calling from Huntington, Long Island.
Yes, hello, Neil.
Hi. Tim's phone seems to have abandoned him. Well, let's see if we can substitute. This would be Rick. Rick's calling from San Marcos in Texas.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay.
I'm calling because I hear I agree that the victims of the sex abuse, I mean, they do deserve some compensation. And actually, my uncle, we suspect, in the fourth grade was abused, and he's suffered throughout his life from it. However, a lot of this, I keep hearing the argument that this is to protect children. And taking the assets of the church and reassigning them to 40- and 50-year-old adults doesn't protect actual children. And it's almost distracting the church from putting efforts into place. And it would almost seem that
I don't mean to cut you off, Rick. I wanted to give David
action suit where a.
I didn't mean to cut you off, Rick, but David Clossy, I wanted to give you an answer, chance to respond. We only have about 35 seconds left.
Well, this is about prevention, not about punishment. And let's face it, in our society, people drive reasonably because they're afraid of the financial penalties of speeding. And because of these archaic statutes of limitations that allow predators to run out the clocks on their crimes, because of that, victims can't get into court, and therefore there's no real incentives for employers to weed out child molesters and to respond promptly when abuse reports come in. And that's what this legislation, these reforms would do. It would give a strong financial incentive to employers to try to prevent abuse on the front end. That's why it's about prevention.
Rick, thanks very much for the call. Again, I apologize for cutting you off.
That's okay. Thank you.
Okay. And David Clossy, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
David Clossy, National Director of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. When we come back from the break, Richard Pryor. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.